Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Oliver Wiseman, CapEx's editor. This May marked the 200th anniversary of the birth of Karl Marx. For many, this was an occasion for celebration, not somber reflection on a set of ideas that, when put into action, have claimed the lives of millions. John McDonnell gave a speech on the enduring relevance of Marx. Jean-Claude Juncker played his part in the fortification of the German thinker's reputation by unveiling a Chinese-funded statue of Marx in Trier. The headline of one New York Times piece simply said, "Happy birthday, Karl Marx, you were right." Why is a man whose ideas have been found not just to be wrong, but dangerously so, still so revered by so many? To find out, I spoke to Christian Niemitz of the IEA. Christian is the author of a forthcoming book on Marxist regimes and their fellow travellers. Okay, so I'm here with Christian Niemitz at the Institute of Economic Affairs to talk about Karl Marx. I spoke to Christian a few days before Marx's birthday, and I started by putting to him Joseph Schumpeter's famous description of Marxist ideology as blind faith. To mark that occasion, I'm going to start by quoting Schumpeter at you, Christian, to get things going.
Go on.
At the beginning of Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, his masterpiece, he says the following. In one important sense, Marxism is a religion. To the believer, it presents first a system of ultimate ends that embody the meaning of life and are absolute standards by which to judge events and actions. And secondly, a guide of those ends which implies a plan of salvation and the indication of the evil from which mankind, or a chosen section of mankind, is to be saved. Now, he wrote that in 1942, and I would say that in the years between 1942 and now, that's still a pretty accurate description of Marx's supporters.
Yes, absolutely. Although you could say in his time, it was probably more the case that left-wing intellectuals would be avid Marx readers. That is not necessarily the case today. Socialism has become very fashionable again. Socialism as an abstract idea is very popular, but I doubt that many of them would want to follow Marx to the letter. They would refer to him, but more as a sort of, I don't know, a sage-like figure. Uh-huh. Like old major in Animal Farm.
So if there's been any progress, it's that they're not as doctrinaire as they once were on the left.
Yes, although I don't know how much that really matters in terms of outcomes. If you look at the glorification of various socialist regimes over the years by left-wing intellectuals, for the more recent examples, they became popular because they distanced themselves quite explicitly from old school Marxist regimes. So when Venezuela mania in the West started, which was around in the mid 2000s, it started actually with a Chavez speech in 2005, during which he said, "We are a socialist government. We want a socialist transformation." But he also at various repeatedly distanced himself from the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact countries. So that was the time when it started off. He had to do this distancing thing of saying, yes, socialism, but not that kind of socialism. And saying this will be genuinely different.
And yeah, you're the author of a forthcoming book in which I think you basically argue that there's this cycle of Western supporters of socialism. They find a new example of socialism that will work this time, Venezuela being arguably the most recent, which is somehow different from all the old ones.
Yes.
If you don't sort of drink the Kool-Aid, it seems blindingly obvious that they're making the same mistake over and over. So yes. why do you think they keep falling for it?
Well, it's I think it's a genuine belief that this time will be different, and maybe a lack of awareness that that is what socialists have always said. There is the wrong perception that previous generations of socialists just hadn't thought about it in those terms, that socialism could be non-authoritarian, that it does not have to have a police state, that previous generations just hadn't thought about that, which of course they have. That idea that this time will be different isn't new at all. That's actually been the case ever since the Soviet Union fell out of fashion. So in the 1930s and 40s, plenty of Western intellectuals were admirers of the Soviet Union. That then fell out of fashion. And in the 60s, same thing happened again, this time Maoist China being the utopia of the day. Even then, that was defined explicitly in opposition to Soviet socialism. So at the time, admirers of Maoist China would have said, yes, we are socialists, but our kind of socialism has nothing to do with the Soviet Union. This time will be completely different. Maoism is the complete antithesis of Stalinism. And that's then when Maoism fell out of fashion, other utopias filled that void. But the argument has always been, this time is different. This is a fresh start.
And one of the interesting things to me, both in your pieces for CapEx and in your forthcoming book, is the amazing fact that there's almost no communist regime too grim to attract kind of Western admirers. So you find admirers of North Korea even, and you find admirers of Pol Pot and these plainly horrendous regimes. I mean, I guess the question is, when we're dealing with those kind of sympathies, it sort of moves away from politics and becomes a sort of psychological problem in many ways. It's impossible to imagine being in that frame of mind.
Yes, I'd even go further. It is actually the most atrocious ones that have attracted the most enthusiastic sympathizers in the West. For in the case of the Soviet Union, it pretty much ended in the 50s when the worst was over. So post-Stalin, the Soviet Union was no longer nearly as horrible as it was before. The gulags were never closed down, but the inmate population fell from several million to, I don't know, a couple of thousand. It was no longer nearly as bad. But that was when Soviet socialism was falling out of fashion. It was the same with Maoism, which was at its most popular at the time when it was most murderous, and fell out of fashion once the worst was over and it moderated itself a bit. There seems to be something about this idea of completely remaking society, which is what the most horrendous socialist regimes did. And the milder ones, let's say Poland or East Germany, Hungary, which were, of course, grim dictatorships, but not genocidal, they didn't quite have that appeal of, we're making a new man here.
You talked about this yourself, but you know, you can look at poll after poll that suggests that the idea of socialism is pretty popular, particularly among younger voters in Britain and America. I think in America, more millennials have positive connotations associated to socialism than they do capitalism, if you ask them about those two belief systems.
That's true here too.
Yeah, and I guess the question is, if you are someone like both of us who have looked at the evidence of when the experiments are run in both these systems and can see that there really is no competition in terms of the outcomes, political and economic outcomes, why have we done such a bad job of fighting this battle of ideas? Why is something that's so obviously failed so popular?
There is something in something about socialism, I think, that appeals to human nature. It makes more intuitive sense. You can be a socialist without knowing much about it, pretty much by default. Socialism is a default opinion. You would, I'm sure you've experienced this, let's say at university, that people would ask you, how did you become a free marketeer? How did you discover those ideas? But nobody would ask your lefty friends the same question. Nobody would ask them, how did you become a lefty? Because, well, you just obviously are a lefty. That's the default opinion. That doesn't need explaining. It's the deviation from that needs explaining. There is an intuitive appeal.
Well, you mean because it's just sort of being nice, sort of this idea of sort of giving stuff to people and is sort of generosity superficially to it that makes it appealing. Is that what you mean by?
It could go even further. It could be, that's not an area that I'm an expert in, but there are people who have argued that from the perspective of evolutionary psychology, mm-hmm. that we have evolved in small tribes and our minds are tuned, therefore, to the economic life of a small tribe. What happens in a small tribe, let's say a hunter-gatherer society, is that all economic activity is purposeful and you cooperate, but you intentionally cooperate and you design economic life. You have the tribe gathering around a campfire and deciding tomorrow we do this, we go on a mammoth hunt and we're going to share it in such way. Everything is deliberately coordinated by the community.
Sort of central planning, but with 12 people rather than 120 million people.
But in a sense, socialist ideas are an attempt to impose that old style tribal economy on a society of millions of people and an infinitely more complex economy, which is, of course, why it doesn't work. That's what Hayek was writing about, saying that this tribal logic makes perfect sense within small communities. We would not have an internal market within the family. You wouldn't want a system where your partner cooks and you do the washing up. You wouldn't want to have a market mechanism to coordinate that. There, completely different rules apply. But we can't organize a large, anonymous society that's based on complex patterns of division of labor in the way in which we would organize a small group. It's just that there's a part of our mind which wants to do that and which refuses to believe that it can't be done.
But even if we have that kind of instinctive, if there's that sort of advantage on the left because of human nature, it's not a particularly difficult argument to make to say, yes, that's what you naturally think, but here's why it doesn't work.
Yes, well, there is always the tendency among socialists to distance themselves from previous examples. So that's why you won't convince anyone by banging on about how bad the Soviet Union was or how bad North Korea is. It's not that people who are sympathetic to socialism today have a rose-tinted view of those examples. Some have, but that's the minority. It's more that it really is a genuine belief that they've just done it in the wrong way. That tells us nothing about socialism, and that next time will be different.
So if you're, let's take a specific example, if you're, the most recent one, Venezuela, is the if you're Diane Abbott or John McDonnell or Jeremy Corbyn, all of whom have expressed their support for the Chavez regime. Forget about the answers they would give on TV. What do you think those people think in private about the way the things have gone in Venezuela and the evident failure now there? Do you think it's just, well, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Has it changed their views on socialism? Or if not, what are the kind of excuses you think they've come up with?
Well, it clearly hasn't changed their views. Otherwise, they would say it. There would be no shame in saying, I was wrong about this. It's not, most of us are not experts on the economy of a foreign country. It wouldn't be a big deal to say, okay, I was fooled by some positive headline figures, therefore I fell for this. Plenty of people have said this. Let's say after the Irish property crash, plenty of people have said, yes, I thought this was a marvelous economic boom, but obviously it wasn't, and I was fooled by some positive headline figures. There's no shame in saying that. No, I guess it's a combination of... firstly, you can always come up with excuses. There's always some factor that you can blame. More hardline socialists are really telling themselves that it's because of saboteurs. Once again, the old excuse is back to Stalinism in the 1930s. There's always some sinister forces trying to undermine it from outside or from within. And well, we've seen the John McDonnell speech at Davos saying, they deviated from socialism, which all economies are, of course, mixed economies. If you look at the Venezuelan economy or any economy, even one of former Eastern Bloc economies, and look for non-socialist elements, you will find them. That's why now a lot of people who were praising the Chavez regime or who are generally trying to dissociate Venezuela from socialism just look systematically for non-socialist aspects of that economy, which there are, of course, as any economy other than maybe Pol Pot's regime being the purest example, but any economy also has non-socialist features. There's no pure socialism, just as there's no pure capitalism. And if you then overemphasize those aspects and say, oh, that's what caused it,
you
have an excuse.
Yeah. If you make the points you're making, the points I've made, you know, these are all, I don't think all these things are true, about, let's take the narrow example of British politics. If you talk about the Labour front bench, their support for Venezuela, their past support for East Germany, whatever it may be, you're basically told that you're a bore, and that you know, yes, that might all be true, but that's not going to change anyone's mind, and no one really cares about these historical examples, which seems to me to be quite a sort of glib dismissal of quite an important thing. So how do you kind of, do you have any thoughts on, and this isn't necessarily your department, but do you have any thoughts on making those points more interesting to people, making them more vivid to people? I mean, these are sort of murderous regimes that we're talking about, and yet this is seen as some dusty economics professors are interested in it, but voters aren't thing.
I think showing those parallels that this isn't really new. It's not just the Corbynistas today, but that's something that's a pattern that has been going on for decades, that you had Western leftists being sympathetic to a regime as long as that regime seemed to be doing well, and then suddenly retroactively distancing themselves from it. That's a pattern that has been going on for decades.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I presume one of the points of the book too is to overcome this kind of double standard in which if you're a right-wing politician or thinker or whatever, and you can make any connection with a far-right organization, present or historical, that is, I mean, you are not, basically you're not allowed to continue in public life, right?
Yes.
Because those regimes were horrible, they killed millions of people, and so on. If you, the same just simply isn't true. I mean, in fact, you get to run the Labour Party if you think those things about regimes that killed tens of millions of people. Fighting that double standard, is that done just through laying out the history to people, or how do you achieve that?
By pointing out that the idea that the atrocities of socialism were just deviations from the ideal, that idea is wrong. They were actually quite consistent applications of socialism. It was not a coincidence that so many socialist regimes turned authoritarian and, well, all of them turned authoritarian, but some even then turned murderous. It's not that they had the misfortune of just having a group of psychopaths taking over, but that actually happened all for systematic reasons. It is, for example, the most of the murders in, or most of the death toll of the Soviet Union and also Maoist China was a result of the forced collectivization of agriculture. That was what caused the famines, totally disrupted the food sector and caused massive shortages. But you can't say that that was a deviation from socialism. Those were, at the time, predominantly agrarian economies. So, of course, if you're a socialist, you would want to collectivize those sectors. You wouldn't say, yeah, we'll collectivize the few industries that there are, but we leave agriculture as it is. So those were absolutely applications of socialism. They were not some random deviations.
And of course, the crucial point there is that the thing that enabled these disastrous policies to continue was exactly that, was that they were ideologically motivated. So, mm-hmm. You know, if you were running the Soviet economy and you started a process of collectivization, if you were not an ideologue, you would stop that process, right? As soon as it became obvious that it wasn't working.
Yes. And in other systems, generally, a lack of economic success does not necessarily cause a crisis. Let's say Ireland until the 1980s was the poorest country in Western Europe. It wasn't particularly successful economically, but that didn't cause the Irish government to become authoritarian in the sense of looking for culprits. Mm-hmm. But in a socialist system, if you have economic problems, there's always been the issue that that's not supposed to happen. So you have to find a scapegoat.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why the socialist regimes always turned authoritarian, why you then get show trials and witch hunts for imaginary saboteurs and foreign spies, wreckers, people trying to undermine it. And that's the big difference between, you can have capitalist economies that don't do well for a while or even for a prolonged period without that having political repercussions. Mm-hmm. That's just, we just have sometimes phases of low growth. In socialist regimes, since there is the idea that socialism is superior to capitalism and this is an economy run by the people and all that, if it doesn't work, you need to find someone to blame.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on slightly to a slightly different point about Marx, which is, we've spoken about regimes, government set up it kind of in his name or following his ideas and how badly that's worked out. There is a sort of more mainstream view although that's obviously that's support for those is arguably way too mainstream, but nonetheless, there's a more mainstream view, which is that yes, communism is a really bad way of running a country, but Karl Marx in his description of capitalism was actually spot on. There's a piece in the New York Times today which is titled "Happy Birthday, Karl Marx, You Were Right." There's a line in there which I'd like to just read out, which is basically the author says, "Educated liberal opinion is today more or less unanimous in its agreement that Marx's basic thesis that capitalism is driven by a deeply divisive class struggle in which the ruling class minority appropriates the surplus labor of the working class majority as profit is correct." So that view is the sort of orthodoxy in 2018, according to the author of this piece. Do you think that's true as a question of analysis? And I mean, about the present day, do you think that's correct? And do you think that view is right? I mean, do you think Karl Marx was right about capitalism?
No, he wasn't. But I would agree with him that that is the orthodoxy today. At least he admits that. It's quite often that people who make that case like to claim that this is somehow an extremely provocative point of view, which, no, it really isn't.
Then let's deal with the actual substantive claim about capitalism. I mean, that's wrong.
Well, Marx wrote, of course, a lot about crises in capitalism. That's why every time we have an economic downturn, especially during the financial crisis, but I've seen this before after the crash of the dot-com bubble in 2000 or so, that you get all sorts of commentators saying, oh, look, there we have an economic crisis. Marx wrote about crises and capitalism. Surely this shows that he was actually right. Well, it doesn't. You have to show that not just that there is some sort of crisis, but that it occurs for the reason that Marx wrote about. In fact, every school of economic thought writes about boom and bust. That's standard fare. That's what every school of economic thought does. That's Keynesians, most famously, but also the Chicago school, the Austrian school of Hayek and Mises. Every school has some theory about why we have boom and bust cycles, why that happens. So if you claim every time that there's a downturn that this shows that Marx was right, you'd also have to claim that this shows that Keynes was right, that Friedman was right, that Hayek was right. They can't all be right at the same time because a lot of their theories are mutually exclusive. So this is a bit like saying something bad has happened, some natural disaster somewhere. Nostradamus wrote about bad things happening. Therefore, this proves that Nostradamus was right.
And so if as you said, he's someone who, like every other economist, has tried to explain crashes, has tried to explain the current system, the market economy, why Marx? Like, why is Marx so... Why does he have such a following? Why is he so revered? What do you think about him?
Yeah, maybe that's not so much about the crisis point, although that's part of it. If you have a general antipathy to capitalism, you will, of course, want to see every downturn in the capitalist
I think
economy
that's,
as somehow
sorry to interrupt, but there's the John McDonnell quote at the time of the last recession where he said, I'm a Marxist. This is a crisis of capitalism. Yeah, for Christ's sake, don't waste it. It's something like that.
Yes, he was hoping for it. Yeah, but sometimes you get economic downturns that really are clearly caused by something that have much narrower explanations. Mm-hmm. The reason why we have this prolonged crisis in Southern Europe, that really is something that you could reasonably describe as a depression. But that is clearly a result of a monetary union that they shouldn't have entered. It was a political project. But that's a much narrower explanation. It's not something that's just a sweeping generalization. Right. This is somehow about capitalism. This has to do with a particular political project that they were pursuing but didn't have to pursue. Could have been done differently.
So, Christian, one last question. You, I take it, won't be booking a plane ticket to go to Trier this weekend to see the unveiling of a new Karl Marx statue with Jean-Claude Juncker, paid for by the Chinese government.
No, I'm not.
Christian Niemitz, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.